Hi, welcome to Petri Dish. I'm Bonnie Petri. With a note, this episode talks about suicide. I'm a suicide loss survivor myself, and I appreciate a warning before that subject comes up. It's Dia de los Muertos in San Antonio, Texas. Day of the Dead. The day in Mexican culture when people remember friends and family who have passed on. It's celebrated at the beginning of November. The streets are a brilliant cacophony of Mexican and Tejano culture. There are family altars, ofrendas, that honor the dead with photos, sugar skulls, marigolds, candles, and pan de muerto, the bread of the dead. This year, there is an unusual altar, encased in mesh, evoking a desert. It's studded with hundreds of dog tags catching light in the breeze, and pictures, at least 100, of people mostly in the prime of their lives. But they're on an ofrenda. They must be dead.
This altar right here is honoring those who die of suicide and lose their battle with their demons in their head. So we're here honoring those veterans.
Gabe Gonzalez is standing alone at this altar, and he acknowledges that so many of these photos appear to be of happy people, but they all died by suicide.
Because there's a battle that, you know, we have that's between our ears, that we suffer in silence, and we put masks on that say, like, we're okay. We're okay.
Masks like those ornate sugar skulls that are ubiquitous at this festival.
And of course, you see them with their kids and smiling and having a good time and fishing. And what happens in the quiet times? What happens when a firework goes off? You know, that's all within the head that usually we can only relate to other veterans for. And even at that, we don't want to open up because we don't want to be known as weak.
Gonzalez knows from experience his photo might have ended up on an altar like this one if it weren't for psychedelics.
I went through a psilocybin retreat in Mexico due to PTSD, depression, anxiety, and Operation Solace came out from that journey. And my story is that it changed my life. It gave me the chance to be here today because there was a time where I wasn't going to be here.
Gonzalez runs Operation Solace. Well, it's really just him. He says he's a one-man show trying to raise awareness about the potential of psychedelic therapies for veterans with psychiatric diagnoses like depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. He says it offers a new kind of mission for wounded warriors.
It's a long-term peace mission for those who are seeking peace in their lives.
But do psychedelics really work for these diagnoses? And if they work, how do they work? What is happening in your brain? And if they can save someone's life, why are they illegal? Good questions. Let's see what kind of answers we can find. From Texas Public Radio, this is Petri Dish. I'm Bonnie Petri. Welcome to Psychedelics and the Texas Trip, Episode 2, The Science and the History of the Medicine.
Support for Petri Dish is made possible by UT Health San Antonio, committed to transforming the health of the community through a team that tackles problems from every angle, doing everything it takes to bring each patient the best possible outcomes, from teaching tomorrow's healthcare leaders to translating research into new treatments. UT Health San Antonio strives to make lives better. Learn more at everythingittakes.org.
Welcome back to Petri Dish. I'm Monty Petri. Our Texas trip started in our last episode in Austin at the Texas legislature with the passage of a landmark bill, HB 1802, that's funding a clinical trial to study the effects of psilocybin for veterans with PTSD. Now the trip takes us to Houston, where that clinical trial is just getting started. Come on, we're going inside.
Today's session is going to be a little bit more about the psychoeducation for the substance. So, as you probably have heard, psilocybin is referred to as a hallucinogen, so you can expect that there's going to be some sensory alterations, subtle changes in the vibrancy of colors, noises might sound a little distorted, your perception of time and thought processes may change also. And this is often how people have certain insights, because they're perceiving things in a way differently from how they usually have.
Reporter Robin Berghaus is working with us on a Ferris UC Berkeley Psychedelic Journalism Fellowship, and she traveled to the Menninger Clinic in Houston, a sprawling 50-acre campus and top psychiatry hospital. There, she observed a mock session to learn how psychedelic therapy works.
Taking psychedelics like psilocybin is almost like a fresh coat of snow. So it allows you to go on a completely new direction than you're used to.
That's good, because this direction isn't working.
Robin, tell us about it.
Well, Bonnie, I was invited into the dosing room with Mia Delmont and Amanda Timon from Baylor College of Medicine, and Ryan Roberts, a Marine Corps combat veteran. It's a cozy living room with soothing colors on the walls, natural light streams through big windows, and there's a plush couch and chairs. The room is designed for safety and comfort because it's here that participants have their hours-long psychedelic experiences. It's also where the team discusses the process and risks so participants are prepared.
You recorded a mock preparatory session. Why not a real one?
It can take several years to get a clinical trial up and running, and the team is just beginning to enroll participants. So we simulated a session with Ryan Roberts, who previously experienced psychedelic therapy. Roberts is a Marine Corps combat veteran who lives in Houston.
Grew up on the East Coast and joined the Marine Corps. So many did, joined the military right after the events of 9/11. And just as it kind of motivated the nation, it sparked something in me. I had no intentions before that to go into the military, no family background of being in the military.
And then in March 2003, Roberts deployed to Iraq. He was involved in the Battle of Anazaria, where U.S. soldiers were ambushed and some were captured. And during the chaos, there was a friendly fire incident, and Roberts lost 18 of his fellow Marines, whom he considered brothers. He survived, but suffered a traumatic brain injury.
And that was kind of my first glimpse of you know, the horrors of what it could be. You can almost expect that that's going to happen. But what I was not prepared for was seeing all of the other horrors, the children, the women, the innocent civilian men. It's beyond words. And I think the military does a great job of kind of training you and preparing you to go and do some of those very, very challenging things. But where I realized it doesn't do a great job of kind of bringing you home and helping you process those things.
When Roberts came home, he worked hard to rebuild his life while burdened with chronic migraines, a substance use disorder, and physical and emotional pain. And for years, he tried a variety of traditional therapies and several mental health medications, but he struggled to heal.
My professional career was crumbling. My home life was crumbling. I had a divorce. My tool was alcohol. And, you know, that only resulted in anger and rage and more bad choices. And at that point, with that shame and guilt, I didn't even want to help myself. That was probably the worst part.
Robert says he got to a point where suicidal thoughts were always on his mind, and he attempted to end his life.
Robin, you know, it does feel like members of the military are just sort of expected to get on with it after they've experienced the kinds of battlefield horrors that history tells us can ultimately kill back at home, even if they don't kill immediately, you know? When I spoke with Dr. Lynette Averill, who is leading the psilocybin trial you're covering in Houston, she said these stories are personal to her, and that is actually what drew her to this kind of research.
My father and my uncle both served in Vietnam. My uncle died in country, and my father died by suicide when I was 3 years old. And, you know, was very interested in how do we save people? You know, certainly that started very much as that little girl of how do we save other people's daddies? And that definitely has carried through. How do we protect families? How do we protect the people who had these experiences? How do we protect each other?
Avril told me that over the years, she realized that there was a big hole in the research where healing should be for far too many people who were suffering.
If you think about SSRIs, you know, our traditional antidepressants, all of those, every single one, is based in the idea if we adjust some of those neurochemicals in your brain, bring them up, bring them down, then ta-da, you'll feel better. And again, for some people that works and that's great.
But it doesn't work for a lot of people.
So when ketamine started getting researched, there was sort of this very significant paradigm shift that happened that thought, maybe that idea that just shifting those neurochemicals is maybe oversimplistic. And when they found, you know, that ketamine has these rapid-acting and robust antidepressant effects and sort of dived into what is actually happening here, there's this sort of flood of glutamate that causes this very rapid and robust increase in synaptic plasticity. And synaptic plasticity is really our brain's capacity to learn, adapt, change.
So, okay, synaptic plasticity. Back up. Please tell me more about that.
I sort of think of synaptic plasticity myself as is really almost the foundation of our existence, because everything we do, everything we experience is ultimately through the lens of how our brain is taking in that information and input and spitting it back out. And that is all in those pathways, all in that the way that the brain is wired. And we know that stress and trauma sort of get in there and shrink up some of those pathways.
Okay, so imagine your brain's wiring as like a forest, right? The trees and branches and leaves, they're all neural pathways that help us process information.
And if you think of a really, just a kind of normal, healthy brain, no injury, no significant mental health, whatever, it's kind of like a pretty dense forest. Lots of trees, lots of branches, lots of leaves, all these things, right? When there is stress or trauma, even a single event, one single car accident, sexual assault, whatever it may be, there's sort of a bit of shrinkage or atrophy where some of those tree branches are going to fall away. Some of those leaves are going to fall away. A couple of trees may go down completely.
When the brain's neural pathways shrink, when the forest starts to die, Avril says, that's when people can get stuck in rigid and self-destructive thought patterns. She says psychedelic medications cause shifts in chemicals that serve as messengers in the brain and help us learn, adapt, and change. It's like turning on the sprinkler for your forest, producing kind of a neurochemical rain shower that feeds it, allowing new trees, new branches, new leaves to grow rapidly. New neural pathways that may allow a person to process trauma by breaking old thought patterns and creating new ways of thinking.
Bonnie, that's similar to what Robert's experienced. After years of being stuck in destructive thought patterns, a doctor he trusted suggested he go to Mexico for Ibogaine therapy. Because Ibogaine is a powerful psychedelic drug with health risks, the medical team there runs tests, and they cleared Roberts for the treatment the day he arrived. He recalls putting on eye shades and laying down, and as the music played and the medicine took effect, his thoughts turned inward.
I mean, it is a deep dive into your soul, into the deepest parts of who you are. And what the experience did for me was it shined a light on how the role that I was playing in my own suffering. And it completely reframes the way that you looked at your traumatic experiences and what you went through. And it allows you to shift perspective at the end of the day. I mean, I became like a great catalyst, because what it does, I would not go back and say like Ibogaine healed me. No, I healed me, but it gave me the opportunity to see that I can heal me, right? And it got me connected to the part of me that needed to be healed.
Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to summarize for you the meeting that I have just had with the bipartisan leaders, which began at 8 o'clock and was...
So how do we reconcile that clearly life-changing experience with this?
America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse. In order to fight and defeat this enemy, it is necessary to wage a new all-out offensive.
That's Richard Nixon in 1971 calling for a war on drugs, which made psychedelics inaccessible for medical research or use for, well, my whole life and maybe yours. We'll dive into that when Petri Dish continues.
Support for TPR comes from the University of Texas at San Antonio's Brain Health Consortium, a pioneering research hub advancing neuroscience, neuroengineering, precision medicine, and more. Learn more at utsa.edu/BHC.
Welcome back to Petri Dish. I'm Bonnie Petri. After Dia de los Muertos, I reached out to Gabe Gonzalez of Operation Solace, who was honoring those veterans whose pictures he so lovingly placed on his ofrenda, and asked him to tell me why.
I get kind of emotional on this. I think my whole life I've kind of suffered from some sort of anxiety. So I chose at 18 to join the military. This was pre-9/11. So I was already not very secure in who I was as an 18-year-old, as many who joined the military, they aren't. When I got out, I carried all of that weight with whatever I was already carrying, physical injuries, mental injuries.
But he tried to push through. He got married. They created a blended family with four kids. They built a life together, and he tried to compartmentalize his anxiety and depression and physical and emotional trauma, but these things eventually demand to be dealt with.
And as the kids got older and we became more successful, things just continued to fall apart. I was not a pleasure to be around. I was mean. I was angry. I was irritable. Everybody was against me. I didn't like anything about myself. The person I looked to in the mirror was just the worst person in the world, and it was me. Everybody was against me. Nobody could do anything right, you know?
A veteran friend told him about psychedelic therapy. The friend, like Ryan Roberts, had gone to a place called the Mission Within in Mexico for treatment, but Gabe didn't think he was bad off enough to need all that. Months went by. His mental health continued to deteriorate until one day he was just, well, he was done. I mean, with everything.
I put a gun in my truck, one bullet, and I drive to a grocery store parking lot. I say my goodbyes. I'm not a religious person at all. Say my goodbyes. I wanted to be in a public place that somebody's going to see me. I'm not going to hurt anyone else, and it's not going to be my family who's going to find me. And I pulled the trigger and the gun jammed. My life just flashed before me. So I make the call to the Mission Within.
He went to Mexico.
I take a heroic dose of psilocybin, which is 5 grams, and it is the most beautiful experience I've ever witnessed in my life. My family is there in my visions, hugging me, telling me everything is going to be okay. And I start crying uncontrollably, just like I kind of am now. Throughout this whole experience, my grandma, who is passed, is walking me through life situations and telling me as a young child, tell yourself you're going to be okay. Look at all you've had. And through these stages of my life, she continues to guide me, to tell me I'm okay. And it was just a beautiful experience. For the first time in my life, I forgave myself for so much. It was like a weight that had been lifted off. And for the first time in my life, I found love. I loved myself. I was welcome to love. I was open to love. And then I came home.
And then I came home. This therapy doesn't just involve psychedelics, you know, the trip. Roberts and Gonzalez did preparation work to set expectations. They journaled and meditated, and they did breath work. And after the psychedelics treatment, they focused on what's called integration.
Definitely the integration is critical.
That's Dr. Lynette Averill, who is leading the psilocybin clinical trial for veterans with PTSD at Baylor College of Medicine and the Menninger Clinic. She says even for patients who have these incredible transformative experiences, that's just a small part of the work they have to do.
There has to also be that preparation work of what are the things that I need to evaluate or be changing at home in my daily life, in my living situation, and in my support system, and, you know, all of those things that we have to go home to after we've had the dose. How do we continue that work? And I think that piece is critical just to kind of give people as much foundation for success as possible.
That's the difference between tripping and healing. Gabe agrees.
Integration plays a very important role in this whole thing, and maybe the most important, because you need to understand how to handle life as you see it with brand new eyes. And if you continue to go down the path of reacting the same way, then you're just deeper into your old habits and it's harder to break.
When Gonzalez came home, he made it his new mission to help other veterans. That mission of peace he talked about at his ofrenda. But because most psychedelics are illegal in the U.S. and the treatments can be expensive, psychedelic therapy can be hard to get.
I want to be more vocal in the community of San Antonio. I want to be the voice that says this is too expensive, that there has to be a way to provide these life-saving services for these veterans and even their veteran spouses and caregivers in a manner that doesn't break the bank for the veterans.
The healing the vets we've talked to describe as a result of these experiences is profound. Robin, was that your impression from Ryan Roberts?
Bonnie, I agree. The experience was profound for Roberts. And while the healing process is lifelong, he said Ibogaine had immediate effects. I asked him to confirm the number of treatments he received because I thought maybe I misheard him.
Yeah. So is it just a single treatment? It was a long treatment. It was about 16 hours in duration. You probably had to scrape me off of the floor with a shovel the next day. And, you know, by the end of that following day, like, you're up on your feet, you're moving, you're interacting.
And Robert says that Ibogaine also helped mitigate chronic pain resulting from brain traumas he endured during combat.
Now, that was almost 4 years ago now, and I was having 3 to 4 migraines a month, and I haven't had one.
Roberts told me that he's not as good as he was before the military. He's actually better than he's ever been. He has a loving family, and he continues to push the boundaries of what's possible with his life. With so much healing potential, why are psychedelic therapies so hard to access in the United States?
That brings us to President Richard Nixon and his war on drugs.
America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse.
All right, Robin, what can you tell me about what was going on back then in the early 70s that led to this crackdown?
Well, Dr. Albert Garcia Romeo, who researches psilocybin with a focus on addiction treatment at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, says Nixon's war on drugs wasn't really about drugs at all. It was about the threat of the counterculture communities in the late 1960s.
You know, the hippies, the anti-Vietnam War movement, the women's liberation movement, the civil rights movement. I mean, that level of social upheaval was really frightening to a lot of people. And, you know, there was certainly a backlash from the powers that be that were wanting to maintain some level of social control. And so that really led to, you know, the outlawing of these psychedelics.
The U.S. Congress passed the Controlled Substances Act of 1970, putting these drugs into what Garcia Romeo calls a deep freeze. It did that by creating a drug scheduling system. Cannabis and most psychedelics were put into Schedule 1. These drugs are defined as having no accepted medical use, and they are illegal to use and prescribe. They can only be studied with a Schedule 1 license. And there were several issues that hindered research for decades. But before that, Garcia Romeo explained, there was a golden period of research into psychedelics.
Yeah, well, actually, I mean, these have been studied for decades as potential therapeutics, and, you know, people were studying them in the 1950s and 60s, potentially as treatments for a range of different types of conditions, mainly within the mental health conditions like depression, addictions, anxiety-related conditions.
From about 1950 through the mid-1960s, more than 40,000 patients were prescribed LSD as a treatment. There were a handful of international conferences devoted to this field, and more than 1,000 scientific papers were published on LSD and psychedelic research.
By experimenting with LSD and other similar chemicals, the results were rather mixed from that early era of research. And I think a lot of that had to do with the way that the drug was being administered. You know, this was like something that had recently been developed. Really, LSD was first discovered to have its psychoactive properties in 1943. You know, I think the findings were a little muddy, and it was hard to really make heads or tails at the time of whether or not these could be useful and how so. And then that really, I think, became much more complicated due to the sociopolitical arena and, you know, the adoption of the countercultural use of these drugs in the recreational settings.
So when did this attitude start to sort of thaw so that there could be a kind of a reboot to psychedelic therapy research?
Garcia Romeo says it was really around the turn of the century when the research started to pick up.
And I always like to quote this famous quantum physicist, you know, Max Planck, who says that science advances funeral by funeral. And the idea is that if people have a very set, you know, idea in mind about how things work or how things should or shouldn't be, then they're not necessarily going to change their minds. But once they are no longer in the picture, then that does allow for new ideas and, you know, a new generation of thinkers and researchers to come along and do things somewhat differently, to, you know, risk their credibility by going back to look at these drugs and try to understand them again from a new perspective.
So what can be done to help the research move along for psychedelics and other Schedule I drugs?
Traditional government funding sources didn't really exist for decades. I mean, it was a hard sell to request funding to study drugs that the government itself defined as not having an accepted medical use. Now that's starting to change, and Garcia Romeo says it would also help if the government would look to the science and change the way it schedules drugs.
We cannot give those drugs to people because they're considered Schedule One, and we have to jump through a million and one hoops to be able to do that, including getting a DEA Schedule One license. I mean, there's all these different levels of regulatory scrutiny that need to happen in science and research. And so the rules that we have, just they don't work. They don't make sense. And I think in general, there's a lot of antiquated ideas about drugs and drug laws that are harmful, and they don't necessarily lead to our ability to do good research or develop things, especially natural products.
like the research Lynette Averill's doing, which has taken several years to get rolling, even with the support of the Texas legislature, does she think there's any chance that Americans will have access to the types of treatments that have changed the lives of Gabe Gonzalez and Ryan Roberts anytime soon?
I think definitely yes. You know, I think the challenge with all research and all clinical trials is that, you know, generally it's just, you know, this very incremental process. But if psilocybin, or I will say hopefully when psilocybin gets FDA approval, even though that would be specifically, depending on which company, either treatment-resistant depression or major depressive disorder, physicians could then prescribe that off-label for PTSD, anxiety, whatever.
Dr. Averill, with all of the roadblocks you and our other guests have described so far, it really feels like you're trying to push boulders up hills. Why are you doing it?
I suppose that at the heart of it, it is that little girl. At my dad's funeral, I was crying in my mom's lap, you know, and sort of said, why is my daddy in the box? And to know that through this work, maybe we're keeping people out of boxes. If there is a chance of keeping people out of boxes, then that's all worth it. If we can save a life, that's a win. A single life is a win. And I will fight for that.
And that's our next episode, The Road Ahead. What would have to happen so folks living in the U.S. who might benefit from psychedelic therapies could safely and affordably access them? That's next on this special Petri Dish series, Psychedelics and the Texas Trip. This episode of Petri Dish was produced by TPR Vice President of News, Dan Katz, Jacob Rosati, Robin Berghaus, and me. Robin and I wrote the show. Jacob Rosati composed all the music and created the sound design. Special thanks to Holly Mashaw for fact-checking this episode, T. Lamb, Joey Palacios, and Gideon Rogers for producing video, photos, and graphics for our website and social media channels, Jack Morgan for his recording from Dia de los Muertos celebrations, and to Malia Wallen, Brian Davies, Tina Holmes, Nancy Trowbridge, and Homa Warren for production support. Petri Dish is a production of Texas Public Radio. This special series is supported by a Ferris UC Berkeley Psychedelic Journalism Fellowship. Now, in the U.S., most psychedelics are illegal to use and to prescribe. Petri Dish does not promote or endorse psychedelics, so please speak with a trained medical professional for your medical and mental health needs. And be well, friends. I'm Bonnie Petri. Talk to you soon.